I was kind of hoping that we would wait a little bit for the people that are coming to further, so I'm glad you're here. I want to especially thank people for coming today. It's been a very long time, and it's been a long and painful winter in more than one way. So, Jenna, good to see you as well. I want to personally take a little bit of the slowness of action on, because I had some bionic treatments about 6 weeks ago and then got very sick, and our team has really kind of been down and out a bit. So and I didn't have any brain cells to work on this, honestly. So please forgive me. It is not for lack of interest and concern on the part of all of the NGEMS folks and anybody else. So I think the purpose of today's meeting really is to get back on track. There's been a lot of work that's been done. There's a lot of information that we really need to dive into, and we need to hear and react together about going forward. So I still remember I'm Judy Resnick from CBIA. This is only week two of coming back into real meetings. So I don't know if everybody remembers everybody, but it can't hurt. Please, if we can start, Carrie, if you wouldn't mind telling us who you are and you are here representing. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Carrie Kelly, and I'm here representing the Office of Policy Management.
I'm Julie Griman, and I'm here representing the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Gold, representing Department of Economic and Community Development.
Ainsley Diamond, Board of Regents for Higher Education.
Ted Junkles, Board of Regents for Higher Education.
Mary Lou Oleski, the Executive Director of Arts and Ideas Festival in New Haven, representing the arts sector.
Thank you.
Chris Brule, the Business Counsel of Fairfield County.
Douglas Hajimichael, Fairfield University.
Lois Schneider, Management Consultant.
Jason Jakubowski, Hospital for Special Care.
Judy Goldfarb, Early Childhood.
Indeed.
Roberta Willis, State Representative, House Amen. Chair of the Higher Education Committee. And Judy, you look like you're in time out over there, early childhood. It's Judith.
Indeed.
Welcome back, everybody. And it's really wonderful to have Judy back with us. I can't believe she's here right after having major surgery. So, an incredible woman.
We try hard. I'm bionic. I now have a matched set of knees.
Yeah.
Anyway. But also, please remember Ames. And we do, in fact, Ames McGinnis, his colleague Dennis Jones, is actually going to join us, we hope, via Skype, but we're having some technical difficulties, it looks like.
No, I actually think you might have done it.
Check.
So while we're looking to do that, I wonder if we can very briefly take up the approval of the minutes from our last meeting, please. All those in favor?
Are you there?
Any opposed? So moved. We have approved minutes. And my hope is that we remember what we did last time. But actually, okay. So, indeed. All right.
Okay, you all set?
We are indeed, and our goal is to sort of tell you what's been happening and what we need to be working on today. So take it, please. Forgive me, I forgot to do something. I've been scolded. Jeannie, where did the sheet go?
Oh, this thing?
Yes, all right. So I've been told that we have to read this. So I'm going to go fast. In the interest of safety, I would ask you to note the location of an access to the exits in this hearing room. The two doors through which you entered the room are the emergency exits and are marked with exit signs. In an emergency, the door behind the legislators can also be used. In the event of an emergency, select the stewardesses. In the event of an emergency, please walk quickly to the nearest exit after exiting the room. Proceed to main stairs or follow the exit signs to one of the fire stairs. Please quickly exit the building. Follow any instructions of the police. Don't delay unless you don't return until you're told or it's safe. In the event of lockdown announcement, please remain in the hearing room and stay away from the exit doors until an all-clear announcement is made. Thank you. Sarah.
Push your button and the mask will come down.
Thank you. Sorry, Ann.
It's working now.
It's on.
It's working. Check.
It's on.
Try now.
Okay. Good. I don't want to look like I'm one of the chairs up here. Then I'd get blamed for everything. Right. Okay. Let me just outline this agenda and see whether it makes sense. But I'll tell you the overall theme. First of all, I just want to go back, and this is as much for my purposes as anything else, to get a sense of how this all fits together, to talk about how this particular planning effort relates to a whole lot of other things going on in Connecticut, because I think several of you raised the question, you know, how does this relate to that, and particularly what's going on in Conskew. And then secondly, we prepared a really detailed interim report, which was submitted at the end of January. And I thought it was, well, there have been a lot of discussion about the data that we've had and how we arrived at those themes. And we've had regional forums over the place. And I just wanted to raise with you the question of whether there are really questions about those data, because we need to move as a commission pretty quickly to saying these are the draft goals for Connecticut. Rather than saying there are 32 goals, they're really probably down to two or three major goals that then the other ones sort of flow from. But before we get to the discussion of goals, what I'd like to do is have a sharing of information about the feedback that two or three of us have had, and several of you in this room participated in the regional forums, what kind of feedback from that. And as a result of that, then come back and have at least an agreement, a sharper agreement about those goals and themes, because that will really frame what the commission does from then on out. And so I think at the end of this meeting, if we can come to a clear understanding, which I'm sure you all have, of, again, what is the unique role of this commission in relationship to everything else, and much a clearer idea and at least confidence with you about the data that really underscore the overall goals we're setting for Connecticut, and sort of have that as an understanding so we can go from this meeting into another phase of the work of the commission. Is that basically, I think, the outcomes, Roberta and Judith, that you really want to have from that? First of all, I got communications from a couple of you, and I know that probably either Judy and Roberta did, and perhaps the other Judy was part of the source of that, saying, excuse me, we have, what is this strategic plan related to that strategic plan? And let me state my understanding, and of course the sponsor of the legislation is here and she can straighten that. But the real intent of this planning effort is to have long-term goals, a long-term plan for Connecticut, which in fact covers the whole higher education system, all the sectors, particularly the public and independent sector, but I would say it's actually all the education system. And so it is a framework within which the planning efforts for UConn and the Next Gen effort is a framework for that. It's a framework for the new strategic planning effort, which Conskew is just beginning. I might talk a little bit about why I think that's important and why it's different. But it's also related to the independent sector. One of the basic questions in this, if you're going to set goals for the education attainment of the population of Connecticut, The independent sector is a major contributor, but one basic question is, to what extent is it reasonable for the state to depend upon that capacity? Because depending on that capacity has a major affordability dimension to it, and it also capacity of those institutions. I mean, some of the institutions may be able to expand, others won't want to. So what is the reasonable expectation for even that sector within the framework? And but there are a lot of other ways. In fact, the for-profit sector plays a major role in contributing in a variety of ways. So this is a framework for all the above. Now, there's a real distinction. If you look at what a system like CONSCU has to do, not only to set the goals for that institution, but a whole set of issues related to their capacity, their facilities, their academic programs that are really CONSCU-specific. What I described, they're much more institutional planning rather than planning for the future of Connecticut. So that's a fundamental distinction for me. It's really important for that system to be doing the planning, but just to convey to you that what they're doing is not what you're doing here. That really, is that clear? I mean, maybe I just should stop there and say, does that kind of overall framework make sense? If I can say from the point of view of Lindy, this framework for Connecticut, for the higher ed part, ought to be absolutely dovetailed with the future of the economy and quality of life of Connecticut. The same way in terms of the other, you know, labor policy and like that. It's at that level. It's not something that, and I'll pick on sort of community and economic development, then your plan, in fact, ought to dovetail with this also. It ought to provide a framework rather than sort of a strategy off here related to workforce or to economic development that's somehow going on a different course. You ought to question now, how does this relate to the overall plan for higher ed on that thing? And in fact, it's really less a plan for higher ed than it's a plan for how you really get an educated population at the higher education level that connects with the future of the state. Okay, let me just stop there and see whether there's any questions about that. I could look at you here and see whether there's anybody sleeping or whether anybody has or is saying, oh gosh, I don't know anything about that. So you, sir, you raised your head up and down. Wait, did you have that was a bad thought.
Actually, it was a thought. Maybe it's not directly related to what you just said. I was looking at the list of people you interviewed in the course of the project, and you have the president of public institutions, but nobody from privates. Of course, Judy Greiman is here, and she can speak
right
for the privates, but no president, let's say, or vice president or provost from any of the private institutions, and if we hope to get them on board, there has to be some kind of community.
You know, one of the things that we talked with Judy about, and in the next phase of this project, I mean, this is, reflects more Dennis Jones and me rather than, you know, Judy and Roberta. But there has to be a much more deliberate strategy to deepen the engagement of a whole lot of people in this effort. We did a preliminary set of discussions with the people from CONSCU for a variety of reasons, the biggest reason being weather. I've had more encounters with Connecticut weather than I needed to have. Those didn't work, but I think we need to think in a way, different way of doing those. So that's part of the public sector. Re-engage the UConn people. We had good meetings with them early in the process. I did come to the meeting with Judy Greiman's board meeting, and we've had good discussions with Judy about that. But there's nobody here from you. Yeah. Right. And, so we'll make sure that we go back to people like that. The other piece, which you touch on, I mean, we've had meetings with regional basis on business and, business and other leadership. If you're going to have an agenda like this, Judy shared with me the membership of the committee, what's the name of the?
The Connecticut Council for Education Reform.
Yeah. If you look at the membership of that group, that's the level that you really need involved in this kind of effort, of a good deal of ownership, you know, that those are really the goals for Connecticut They aren't just the goals for an institution or for a sector and that kind of thing. And that's the same time, Chris, the same group, kind of group that you get involved in Fairfield County. It's actually a pretty good example. It includes both the higher ed people and business leadership from Fairfield County. It's almost that kind of group that you need to have. In other words, so the point is taking you all as a beginning point and then really deepening the involvement of a whole new set of people, and even the arts, believe it or not, maybe.
Well, that's my question. I mean, I think that New Haven's regional meeting was a victim of snow, and in fact, I was told that the meeting didn't happen, but evidently it did because Lindy was there. So I think
it was in New Haven.
It was in New Haven. It was on a snowy day. You know, CCER, is that the acronym? Yeah. Organizations like that are really representative of large employers, but I am concerned that the diversity of our perspective may be only limited by that when, in fact, we have a huge nonprofit sector, you know, some of which is devoted to arts and culture, obviously, but even more broadly. So, I'm concerned when we say we're going out and we're having regional meetings with employers, but we have, you know, probably the largest per capita number of nonprofits of any city in New Haven, and I'm not sure who from that sector was even in the room. So I'm wondering
really
about diversity.
Point.
So
yeah, so this has gotten, I guess the message is this cannot be the end. In fact, you know, it's constantly building a larger circle around these points. When we get back to the discussion of goals, one of the things about the goals is to really keep thinking of them expressed in a way in which they will really gain the ownership of a broader group of people. It's, you know, when you say this is a strategic plan for higher ed, most people think this is a plan for an institution. There are people running institutions in the state. That's not our role. Our role is really connecting higher education to the future economy and quality of life of Connecticut. So that's kind of okay. Are there any other points about that, Roberta? Or?
The only thing I would add there too is we do have a list of the employers that did attend. At some point when I am a little more together, what I will do is put it together. I don't know that everybody want, you know, I don't know that I want to make this public to the entire world, but I think the commission should know who attended. I mean, you know, in Fairfield County, it was a robust group. I mean, they're very different in every part of the state, but it would be helpful, it sounds like, if we shared with people the types, and they were all large, small, medium, from all sectors involved. So you've helped remind me that that's also important. Thank you.
I really like the idea that you mentioned the nonprofits. I think that is, they are employers besides being part of the economy. And as I mentioned to Judy, the only nonprofit we had hospitals, which are big and which are not for nonprofit, but they did attend. But in terms of other, you know, large organizations, you know, we didn't engage them. So,
yeah, one of the themes that we can get back on this with the regional forums, at least that I heard, was what makes Connecticut livable, and you know that both relates to cost of living, availability of transportation, but it's also the quality of life that. A whole things related to arts and other things like that are really essential. So in some ways, you can work on the supply side of graduating more people. But a lot of the feedback I think we've gotten from employers is we need to have people stick in Connecticut. And higher ed has a major sort of peripheral effect on that. It has a lot to do with the communities. And so the nonprofits have exactly the same role. You know, that, excuse me.
If I could just add one more thing, I mean, we're talking about economic and community development. We should remind ourselves that arts as a catalyst for placemaking is a big part of our DECD's agenda,
right.
Not to mention supporting the arts. I mean, I heard the governor yesterday in an event talking with great pride about his investment in the arts in terms of quality of life issues and wanting to do more. And frankly, these sectors can only survive if, in fact, we're training people in order to run them efficiently and contribute to them effectively. And I, you know, I get a little bit worried if we're not talking about that part of the equation.
Yeah. I just
thank you.
As some of you know, I spent a lot of my life in Maine, and I just came from a conference that the major theme of it was that there was no economy left in Maine except the nonprofit sector. In fact, some of the research facilities have been attracted from tax benefits even to places like Connecticut. No, I'm not to pick on Jackson Labs, but anyway, so how you operate an economy with nonprofit sector is an interesting one all by itself. Okay, so yes, ma'am. Yes, Tony.
Future plan for higher education, we have to really worry about the demographics of the state because it does affect it. We had a problem with losing our young graduates as they immigrate out to other states that have job opportunities and a future that they can look forward to. And that's one of our big issues in Connecticut is that we have an aging population. The real meat of our workforce is leaving to other states with opportunity. And how that affects our higher educational institutions is huge because we've seen a decrease in enrollment. And we need to differentiate if that's a national trend affecting everyone or if it's more severe in Connecticut. So your comments are well taken, and I'm sure when you canvass the state, it's clear, and I would imagine our business community has found that very much the case, that our other policies, not education policies, but our tax policies are affecting the demographic trends that we're experiencing. And we want our higher education institutions to be robust and be an attraction. On the other hand, we can have very attractive higher education institutions, but if we can't keep those graduates here, it's not going to be as additive to our economy, except for that short time frame when they're here taking advantage of our great education. We've got to be able to secure them, keep them here, and have them help our economy to grow. So we're kind of interconnected between the economic policies along with our educational policies together.
Yeah, I think that, in fact, we'll come back to that in a couple of different ways, maybe three different ways. First of all, I thought we could maybe switch a little bit quickly to the data parts of it to see whether there are any points of the data that are some concerns. So the next thing is maybe discuss the regional forums because the themes that you mentioned, I think, came up during those. But in some ways, and I'll just sort of say this in my own words and we can come back to this, if you really talk about the goals that we're talking about, there are probably only two or maybe three. One is to get a population and of this state that is really competitive across the range of post-secondary education. And the second one is how higher education contributes to sort of the economy and quality of life it retains and can employ that population. So you really, there's both the supply side and then the contribution of higher education that makes to making this being a place that can employ and retain people. So, I mean, they're really both sides of that picture. Okay, now, you all have a summary of the data that we had, and that's beginning, it's on page 2 of that document. Do you all have that? Okay, if I'll tell you what the easiest thing goes for. I can summarize this by headings. Let's do a negative thing. How many people do not have this? Okay. But you've read it and digested it. Totally. Okay. Yeah, let me just summarize the major points, and then I think that the real beginning point is the education attainment of the state. If you look at the 25 to 34-year-old population, or basically the workforce-level population, you're talking about a population today which is about 56% of the population with some post-secondary education, and that's, given the data, that primarily is probably associate degree and above. And if you look at any reasonable workforce projections of this state, it will require at least 70% by 2020, and what we've said that 70% by 2025 is really what the state ought to really focus on. And there are a whole lot of reasons for that. Part of that underlying that that those data are projections by Tony Carnevale at Georgetown University. So there are a whole lot of other reasons, and one of the things we've used is comparison with other OECD countries. And if you look at OECD countries, the places that actually companies in Connecticut are employed in and have companies in fact, those countries are increasingly going to be at 70% if they're not pretty close to that. I'm talking about basically 25 to 34. And that figure is not just the percentage of people with baccalaureate degrees. It has got to include certificates, and we can have some discussion about what we mean by certificates and associate degrees. So, in fact, some college today is increasingly meaning certification. The problem inevitably is that you have some people with some college that has not been brought together. In fact, we had an example of that this morning with the IBETS program. In other words, somebody with some college, but it hadn't been certified. So it's really getting a stock of people at that level. And that's probably more, if you say anything related to a fundamental goal, our point of view is the data really emphasize that. So let me just stop there and say, are there people here who say, you know, if you talked about that 70%, would that have any credibility? Does the data speak to you in the same way, or does not have any credibility? Let me just... You're saying yes. And so why, from Fairfield County's point of view, is that important?
Well, maybe I'm not addressing it directly, but the bigger picture of the demographic picture of the state and the disparity between the attainment levels in the current workforce and the demand level that we're going to need in the near future, and the inability to meet that need simply through traditionally aged students, and the importance of therefore broadening out our focus to include adults as the primary source, which is, you know, indicated here, just ties in directly with both the anecdotal and the survey data that we have from our employers. And it's employers of all size, large and small, that and it's one of the reasons why, you know, at every level we are extremely pro-immigration. We are extremely pro, you know, anything that can bring more people in with what we need for the
yeah, it's bring skills. People in and retain people and produce, you know, graduates and that.
But also to the extent that we define the problem of loss of younger people as the primary problem, I think it's the underskilled staying in place worker who's even more significant than the lost young adult leaving, because the state also imports young adults, and so therefore the net loss annually in the 35 and under group is not as significant to the state as the underskilled worker who's with us and is not leaving and will be with us through the rest of his and her career.
Yeah, if you some of the data that we shared with you just underscore that the 70% figure we're using is actually the product of both degree production and the capacity of the state to import educated people. In other words, it assumes that you'll be able to continue to do pretty significant in importing of people with baccalaureate degree and above. The real Achilles heel is really the next category, which is education of subpopulations, which you really point out. I mean, this state, by any economic review that I've read, the really Achilles heel of the state is it has the most incredible disparity between high income and low income of almost any state in the country. And you're also the in-migration of that population, sort of a bimodal distribution. of still a pretty significant in migration, which I don't think is it's migration. I think not only from people keep having to think of immigration from Latin America, for example, which is not only the case, it's actually migration of populations to more affordable housing, which they're finding in urban cores within Connecticut, from the New York metropolitan area or elsewhere. So, but the numbers are increasing. And then basically the next part of the data that we showed you, that you really cannot get there from here without the populations you just mentioned, adults, and without narrowing the disparities, particularly with the Latino American and African American populations. So I guess one of the things that I, and several of you participated in the regional forums, I didn't get a sense of people understanding the second point. As, in other words, the extent to which the state really must make a measurable difference on the urban core populations, or the state's going to be in trouble. I mean, it's, I didn't.
The ones that I was at, that people were more focused on keeping people here and the people who are leaving,
right,
as opposed to dealing with what you have here.
Right.
Dealing with the hand you were dealt.
Right, exactly.
I mean, I would also say that, you know, that the issue of the urban core population is befuddles, you know, I think people, it's a difficult issue, everybody knows it's a difficult issue, but I don't think that the business community truly, or employers in general, truly understand that they need the bodies. I mean, just in terms of the numbers of people, even just if you replace the workers that are already there, the only available, the large pockets of available labor force are our urban core, but what's hard to understand is that the people are there, but they don't have the skills, and they don't have the disparity in the skills gap and in educational attainment won't solve the demographic problem. The bodies will, but they're not the right bodies. And I don't know that that understanding at all of the regional forums, I think it's sinking in. I think perhaps, you know, more so in Fairfield County, because you have a very different mix. And the conversation in Fairfield County was probably the most distinct from all of them. But I basically don't think people got that piece at all.
It shows up more in the health sector. You know, the difference between the people actually coming in the emergency room, you know, when you're in the forum in Litchfield County, and the skills of the healthcare workers.
That they actually did. I remember that comment distinctly, which is that we cannot serve people from diverse backgrounds if we don't have people from diverse backgrounds who understand not only their language, but are you know, culturally themselves in you know, similar backgrounds. It was really a very interesting wake up.
The other, I think the other point that we'd, just to underscore that people, I don't think, have recognized that if you're talking about the population of Connecticut, that all the population growth is really within this population. So, I've been in a number of states where people, this is not exactly a thing you'd want to repeat, but you're saying, well, we have this population here, we can't educate, but our answer is really to import other people, which really implies that population is sort of beyond reach. And talking about creating a society of, you know, really division is a major part of it. So I think the next issue related to that is sort of the pipeline as a whole, and we shared data with you about the number of people getting in and the number of people getting through. And I think there are a couple of parts about that. Is first of all, if you look at Connecticut, you cannot get from here to there without dealing with the adult population. And that means getting significantly more people engaged and recognizing that the current system is not particularly good, comparatively speaking, with serving the adult population. So there have to be, that's a major area that, of course, came up in your, if you had to say, maybe I'd pick on maybe the discussion in Roberta's committee this morning, you could talk about improving affordability for higher education for young graduates, primarily from the non-urban core parts of Connecticut, and think that you're really happy because the more vocal people about affordability will tend to be middle-income families, and you can do a beautiful job with recent high school graduates. If you target all your resources on that population, you, in fact, could be going backwards rather than forwards, because the real populations that need to be reached are, in fact, likely to be adults who are employed in one form or another, plus they have got to be populations with really severe issues that may be well served by something like the IBEST program and everything to get them up to speed and into the point where they can get certified knowledge and skills. So that's a major part of, when you come out of this meeting, you will have agreed that that's a major part of the priority. And then the question is how we get a group of people really understanding that issue. And then the subpopulations of the Latino, Hispanic, and African American populations. One commercial I just constantly repeat, but I think it reflected in our meeting with the Black and Hispanic Caucus, is that generalizations about the quote-unquote minority population are generally likely to be wrong. You know, there are really strategies that need to relate to unique cultures and circumstances of different populations that are really important. I know that more in a stark way in dealing with the populations, the difference even between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, you know, where people have come from and the points to which they refer. If I just talk about the Dominican Republic, 10% of the GDP of the Dominican Republic is in remittances from the United States. The Dominican Republic is linked at the hip with the populations here in this country. I would just laugh. I work with the president of Dominican Republic, who in fact campaigned for presidency of the Dominican Republic by visiting New Jersey and Rhode Island. So that will give you some sense of the connection. But the more important thing is that parents reference their expectations for their kids with things that are happening in the countries where their relatives are. And so getting a shared understanding of how you bring all that together is really important. And there are same issues related to the African-American population, great diversity within that population and needing to work. And so anyway, with that in mind, I think that the other issues we talked about, the student pipeline. Let me just touch on this. If you look at where degree production occurs in this state, rather than maybe my summarizing, how would you characterize from what you've read the differences across higher ed on who gets through and who doesn't get through? Where are the real gaps? This isn't a test. I'm just curious. If you were to put your money in one place, who gets people through more than anybody else? To a degree. Yeah.
So our four-year institutions with baccalaureate.
Yeah.
At UConn.
Yeah. It probably, UConn, for reasons that is at Sally, and she's before, she was not quite sure why this would be the case. But anyway, UConn actually does very well for students who admitted to UConn, get through to a degree. And what my measure here is not a graduation rate. If you look at the number of graduates per 100 undergraduates, UConn does very well in that way. And that can occur from a variety of reasons. If you have a measure like I just described, in fact, an institution which takes transfers is advantaged by that measure because a number of the undergraduates are not first-time students. That number, in fact, they're getting a lot out for the people they admit. Actually, the Connecticut State University students do reasonably well, but there needs to be significant improvement in that basis to get anywhere near where these goals are. The community colleges are way down compared to other similar community colleges in other states. I think one caveat you've got to consider is whether the data systems in Connecticut are picking up reverse transfers. That is, students who graduate from the community colleges and go to a four-year institution, get a degree, but are transfer students and the community colleges are not recognized for degrees. Be that as it may, compared to other states that have exactly the same problem, the numbers are low in Connecticut. So whatever has to be done, getting more people through to associate degree is one of the things that really needs to happen. Yeah.
Hi. Once again, I'm Ainsley Diamond from the Board of Regents for Higher Ed. A couple of pieces that I've just been thinking about while we're listening to you speak is that I know that weather has been a huge, huge implement to some important conversations that have needed to happen specifically between to update the data. The data that is here is irrefutable. We're talking about 2011 and 2012, and I hope that we have the chance to talk about the amazing progression that has happened at our community colleges and the plans that are taking place right now to address much of what you're talking about. I just hope that we can have the chance to highlight the good work that is being done on initiatives like Go Back to Get Ahead, our transfer and articulation policy. Really, it's kind of all bottlenecking right now. We're having all of these initiatives come forth. So I hope we get the chance to, again, bring you back to the Board of Regents
to discuss. Let me just stop you a second.
Please do.
One of the things we don't want to have in here is people constantly coming up and saying, oh, well, you're ignoring me. And the Board of Regents, we're not putting you on the defensive, okay? In fact, most of the discussion in the forum that I had with your members, and Judy participated, was about all the good things you were doing. So you won't have much patience with me with suddenly saying, oh, well, look at all the good things we're doing. Frankly, you're beginning at a mouse level, and we need to give you all the support we possibly can for the very good things that you're doing. So that's the message we want to convey. But just listen to me, and in this way, we definitely agree with you. There was not a defensive sense in one of the forums we mentioned. In fact, most of the discussion we had was the good things going on in early college, the good connections with the community colleges on K-12, the benefits of the system, in fact, getting things to work together. And so that's kind of what we'd emphasize. But for this commission, the real issue was making very clear to the public that we have a major problem, okay, that even goes way beyond what the Board of Regents may be now working on, okay?
Discover, you have to know, you know, what the issues are to make it better, to improve it. Otherwise, you just stay, you become a politically correct body here. And what good is that for our system? Does that really help business and industry and our labor force? We need to find out where our weaknesses are. We applaud our strengths. That's great, but that's not going to take us to a higher bar. So we need to find out what those are in a way to fix it and make it better and improve. So on that, I'm very interested in what the reasons for the fact that those numbers are difficult, and some of them could be controllable and some of them may not be controllable. It may just be our system, as you said, that we now transfer a whole lot more of our community colleges seamlessly into the state university system. But that taken aside, we do need to know what is happening. If it's something in the system, is it that we just layer them with remediation courses at the beginning so that they just fall off, as discussed on the higher education committee before?
Yeah, if I just go back to what we need to do on the next phase of this, if you're just going back to your point, there are a whole lot of good things going on in Connecticut. And what people need to hear from this effort to say that we need to recognize what you're doing. But I would bet you on virtually every one of those initiatives, the investment in those things, whether it's, say, early college programs, needs to be probably 2 to 3 times even what the recent initiatives are to make a dent in these things. So we will come back and learn all those things because we want to lift them up and give them more. You know, but your comment would need to be updated. We're going to be updated but we want to make sure we get the basic message very clear.
Sorry, I would add one thing, Ainsley, and I couldn't agree with Ames more. If you remember, we started the meeting with saying, really, we have two goals. And the first is to improve the overall educational attainment of Connecticut. And it is not saying that there aren't good things happening. It is saying that if we just look at data and current data, the state of Connecticut is in trouble. And these are the areas where we need to support in many ways, financially and policy-wise and otherwise, so this can happen. It is not a finger-pointing game. It is really about let us understand what the challenge of the future is and how we need what we might do to get there. It's not about saying who isn't and who is. It's about saying we all. So I and having worked in the community colleges, open and, you know, confession here, I get it. I mean, my heart is there, and I know how hard everybody works, and I know the CSUs and UConn and the privates do as well, too. Everybody thinks they are. But the problem is of scale and scope in Connecticut. What we are doing is little bitty steps, and what is called for now is solving more, maybe not world hunger, but, you know, somewhere in between the bitty steps and here. And the only way we are going to get there, as Senator Boucher said, is we have to acknowledge the data and look at what can we do to support that going forward.
I just want to say that for me, this process, and I think Tony, Senator Boucher probably feels this way as well, it's very important for us as policy makers to have this information so we know what policies to invest in. Because everybody comes into this building and tells us what a great thing they've got going and could we get some funding for it. But as policymakers, we're saying, okay, you know, where are we trying to go and what should we be investing in? So when I look at this information here, I know that we need to do more because we're not going to get to the promised land otherwise. And I look at things like the issue of which go back to get ahead, or get ahead, go back, depending on which way. You know that something like that is geared to something we've identified now in this report. It's saying that 25 to 40-year-olds, I mean, this is where we're going to have to go to get to the number of certificates and degrees that we need held in Connecticut. So it's, you know, we're doing things in Connecticut, you know, and I would tell you the community colleges, and we don't have enough resources, you know, but how do I know as a policymaker what I'm supposed to be, you know, when you come with a great idea, is that really where we need to be? So this is very valuable process for us all to be able to massage and think about when people come here and ask for money.
Yeah, and I think the good news of the one forum we have is I think the things that are on the table, and I just listened to your hearing this morning, happen to be really well correlated with exactly these kinds of goals. I mean, that really is a good goal. The real issue tends to be, boy, you should probably be doing 5 or 6, 10, you know, 10, well, the, for example, the IBEST discussion is a very good strategy. How many students is it really achieving? And if that's really a very effective strategy, it probably needs to be a scale probably 10 times what it is. So it's kind of raising the expectations. So I hope that's encouraging. That's great. So anyway, any other comments? You should get a prize for putting up with mine. Okay, then the other issues relate to the workforce, and we will talk about this a little bit. I want to come back. The message I wanted to get, there are differences in the extent to which people get through, but also there are major differences on the contribution of the sectors to getting degree production in this state. If you talk about overall the state could do significantly more, and there, we can get into this later in the discussion of the meaning of certificates. But if you look at the overall state, you have a commitment of UConn to enroll more students, and which implies that they will have a share, but you could put all the money in UConn, you couldn't possibly meet the capacity just that way. It's really going to depend upon the Connecticut State University, the community colleges, and a very major role for the independent sector. And talking to Judy, it's probably not, you won't, there's a group called the COFI institutions, which are tend to be highly selective. It probably will not be places like Yale and Connecticut College and Trinity and Wesleyan, but it will be the other independent institutions that are deeply engaged in their region, who tend to be serving students in that region, that will really be a major. They produce a major part of the degrees in Connecticut. So when you talk about how do we get from here to there, it relates to not only shares across the sector, who is serving people now, their different, the extent to which they now get people through to a credential. And so, and Dennis and I will share with you a model which shows you if you're going to set a goal like 70% in the future, what relative shares across the system could various sectors really need. Okay, on the workforce, oh, that's germ-free. That's great. Germ-free. I was just going to share another germ.
She said
that
we've all had a cold.
She said it was some allergy. What is that?
Yeah, right. Okay. Okay. The workforce needs, I think we can skip over that roughly because I think we've discussed that. I think that there are, because we'll have a discussion actually in the regional forums, there are some real gaps when it relates to STEM and the health fields. If you look about employment in this state and the degrees degree production in that area, which really implies this state is a major depender on you know, importing degrees in areas that are really critical to the workforce. And we might come back on that on the regional forums and see whether we say that and see whether there are any other points. I guess that's basically the last part I wanted to just touch on is that if you, there's a page in here, page 6, that says, okay, if you are going to get to the 70%, what would you have to do? And if we go back after this task force meeting, if you could really focus on that, because if you're really going to get from here to there, you would have to do a first-rate job getting people through K-12 and narrow all a significant part of the gaps on getting more people college ready, but also narrow the gaps related to minority participation, almost to the level of best performing in the country. But at least, for example, on minority completion of secondary education ready for post-secondary, that at least gets up all the population, including the urban cores, to the area's at least statewide average. The high school graduation rate, again, is part of that. The other one is that you'd have to move each of the sectors, the community colleges and the state universities, up to at least best performing in the country as a minimum. You'd have to do probably the same thing related to the independent sector. But you could do almost nothing unless you really narrow the participation of the 20 to 29-year-old group. In other words, you could do it on the fumes of recent high school graduates, but you'd have to narrow that. And the point is that that might cost up to the neighborhood of $350 million to do that. Looking at legislation. Right. But anyway, what you really need to do is look at the model on the returns to the state in terms of income tax, and improved economy, and incomes of people are overwhelming for that investment. So the message is not just investing more money, but the returns to the state of actually doing that are pretty significant. Okay. So we came out of that with a set of themes, but what I'd like to do, Judy, is just shift to the regional forum and maybe ask you what just to go down those and see whether you think what stands out from you just from the overall.
I'm bad. with the exception, perhaps, of the meeting in Stanford, it was very difficult to get the participants off the theme of the inadequacies of the K-12 system. It was the first thing in every single session that came up is it was really sort of they don't trust what a diploma means. They not only aren't the academic and thinking skills there, but the employability skills. And that wasn't just for the high school graduate anymore. So it was a very difficult theme to get people off of K-12, I thought. The employability skills piece we heard at all levels. It wasn't just 2-year college graduates, 4-year college graduates, or university-level graduates. There is a perception, and no judgment, that the quality of what we call professional skills, some people call them soft skills, the quality and quantity, they're gone. And that people don't know how to show up on time and they don't know what to do with technology. So I don't want to do a lot of that, but it really was a serious theme.
And that's why they talked very highly in 2 of them on the Votech schools, because they said that the students that came out of the Votech schools who then went on to central or the state university systems, those were the most desirable employees because those students had the degree, but they had the skills, which was very important.
And that the skills came from work-based learning and internship stuff. And that became a general theme at all levels of higher education as well, beyond the technical high schools. The value of getting people into the workplace, work-based learning, it's the IBEST, it's the contextualized learning, that the value of that is immeasurable both for the student, clearly, so that they understand what they, you know, what the work world looks like, but it's also very helpful to the employer. So I don't know if that's what you were looking for.
Do we have any data on people who've been involved in internships at the college level being in Connecticut, being hired by employers in Connecticut? Because I know students who do them either through law school or graduate school generally take a position with that firm that they did their internship with.
I don't know about data in Connecticut. I just know in general, I mean, just deal with there's a basic point on medical education that doctors, let me put it this way. I've been in a number of states that say, well, we have a significant doctor shortage and we need a new medical school. The real question is where clinical experience takes place. And, you know, so really building strong opportunities for residencies or in students. There are practical reasons why that happens in that people are located and they tend to have family and roots that tend to grow around where they happen to do clinical experience. But I think that generally is the case. But I think the point that Judy just mentioned, there are more Judys here for Squared. I think the feedback we got, this was that, in fact, I don't know whether the words, now that I listen to your hearing, whether contextualized learning has any meaning. But the opportunity for what you're mentioning, Judy, for students at every level of the system to be engaged in some form of, it may be internship, it may be apprenticeship, but I think it has a lot to do with what happens in the institutions that are doing a lot of service learning. In other words, students are out engaged in the community doing things. And my experience is, as you all know, that's a really hard thing to, in fact, that kind of reform is hard to bring about within an institution. It takes faculty time. It takes time organizing that kind of experience. It takes time and the capacity of places to do the internships. you know, if you have a lot of small employers, that came up, small employers cannot afford to do that. So the question, it has roles of chambers and others to provide, and trade associations to do it. So that is a major theme. So the question is, if that's a priority, then what kind of policy changes need to be made at every level of the system to kind of make that possible? But I think we heard more about that than virtually, and whether people show up on time.
Right. Can I comment on that?
Yes, sir.
I taught internship programs for 41 years at three different colleges and universities.
Right.
And I can tell you it was the best learning experience for most students that they would ever have, because they did have to learn how to dress, how to talk, how to act professionally, how to be there on time, how to do what's
right.
ever asked of you, and in many cases to be told bluntly, you know, that you're not very good at this, you've got to improve in this area. On the other hand, in many cases, the students got tremendous encouragement out of the internship because they were told by professionals in the field working at that time that they were, you know, clearly on the right path. They were close to being, you know, close to graduating, close to being able to fulfill the professional requirement. When I took over my program at Southern, I had one student the first year from the person who died actually previously. And when I left, one year we had 95 students in the program in one semester. So, I mean, it isn't that difficult. Once you have taken a couple of years to make the contacts and you have a database
right.
and you can refer to people, you can do a very good job at it. I met with my interns every 2 weeks, in some cases every week, and I never found it to be onerous. I did it in the summers and everything else, but it was tremendously useful. And it could even be done at the high school level. They could have short little practicums where they
right.
would go for 4 or 5 days to something to see what it's like. I just wanted to ask two other questions. So I was surprised in the results of the regional forums about one thing. CBIA did a study, I believe, about 5 years ago in which they polled employers in Connecticut, and they were asked questions about whether there was they thought students graduating from UConn and CSU were adequately trained to do the jobs. They both rated both university systems very highly. It was like an 85% approval rating, I think, and an 80% on one. But it was a very positive response, and I used it as advertisement for my students when I was recruiting interns. So I'm wondering if the complaints aren't somehow conditioned by the fact that the public schools for a long time, you know, didn't produce people who were adequately trained. My other question is that with the passage of the new curriculum laws and the new tenure and retention laws in Connecticut, I have grandsons who are in kindergarten, pre-K, first grade, and second grade, all four. And they've learned more than I would have ever imagined. I mean, in the last 2 or 3 years, there's been an incredible improvement. The kindergartner can read as well as I could at the end of the first grade. And, I mean, I ended up Phi Beta Kappa at one time when I was an undergraduate, so I got through the system okay. But I think there are major changes being made in the public schools today that are very good. But I'm wondering if this isn't in some ways a reflection of the fact that there was a time when you could look at some of the city schools and see that 94% of the students, you know, couldn't pass the math and English exams.
Yeah, one of the things that I think, again, those of you who participate in the forum can verify this, one of the things that I think was really encouraging in most, I cannot think of almost any comment in those regional forums where people were saying the graduates of this, you know, Southern or something like that, we're not satisfied with them. In fact, the reverse was the case. Most of the examples were good relationships they had with the local community colleges, in fact, dealing with the very problems they were talking about. So they were thinking more of higher ed and the community college as part of the solution, rather than, you know, the graduates were getting, for example, from Gateway, or in fact, Gateway was seen as one of the major partners in helping them deal with
right.
a population that, and the comments about UConn, again, there were not that many, but people were generally, you know, positive, particularly about the plans that UConn has. So I just underscore what Judy said, that it was very hard to get people off K-12, and we, you know, kept, I think Roberta said about 10 times, this is the higher education, that, you know, we aren't reforming K-12.
It's very important about what employers are saying about graduates, and I was hoping that that had changed, because some time ago I was also being told by businesses that they had graduates from high school where they had to actually employ in their businesses, the big insurance companies. I don't know, Chris, if you have found that. And Laura, they had to employ teachers to come into their businesses to teach basic math and writing and grammar so that they could become good employees. That disturbs me that there's still some of that going on. And there's also the life skill issues that are so important about showing up for work, dressing properly, in fact, interacting with manners in a respectful way and with colleagues within the workplace. Oftentimes that's what produces someone being fired more than even the knowledge base that they have. This is a big concern and speaks to, again, the growing achievement gap that hasn't gotten any smaller. We hope that stronger curriculum that's being laid out now, that is somewhat controversial, but now this speaks to the fact we do need something to do that. But we concentrate on the higher ed, and where higher ed can play a big role in this is the programs we have at our universities that prepare teachers to go into the classroom, that new wave of student teachers and how well prepared they are. And I had brought to my chairs the feedback I get from a district of 7 different towns, some very similar, some very different, and the superintendent's feedback to me in that they get differing qualities of teacher candidates that are produced by our state university system versus UConn. UConn has a very high bar for its teacher programs. You have to have a very high SAT. They tend to be the cream of the crop. They have a very intensive program, and the graduates, once they hit the ground running, and that's why we've entertained language that would improve that teacher preparation program in all of our programs in our state university systems, where they start to spend more time in the classroom earlier on into the educational program. More boots on the ground to be prepared and to be able to actually be better at the teaching environment, even though so much of what they get is out of their control. But at least the controllable part, the part when they are in the classroom, we need to do something to prepare those children, and maybe why we speak to having career academies at the high school level so that they get practical time in business, for example, and that's where business can partner with them. But I'm sorry to go on like this.
No,
I just
wanted that's excellent.
Give you that feedback.
In fact,
that
relates a little bit to the discussion about CONSCU, because my sense is that if you looked at the state universities today, there are all sorts of good things going on exactly on the point you just raised. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we will learn about those, but I think what we'll find is it would need to multiply the good things that they're doing multiple times. But it's not because they aren't doing things. It's just that the level of need, particularly the engagement, the biggest gap in the USA is the preparation of existing teachers to implement the Common Core. And the question is whether higher ed is deeply engaged, even with current teachers, to prepare for them for that transition, as well as, because you've got such a large proportion of your teachers who are there and going to be there. The question is, so it's both the current generation and the next generation. But anyway, yes, ma'am. And thanks so much for coming. Okay.
Just one quick comment. There were nobody pointed fingers at any college or university as not being turning out a good product, especially in the academic discipline. It's this other stuff that they couldn't get their heads around, and it didn't matter what level it was, this employability skill stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't think there was anybody, and being the CBIA person, we do constant surveys in different sectors. I think that was the manufacturing one we did in 11. But it's still the case that and particularly the community colleges, they had wonderful relationships. In most of the regions where we were, they all mentioned by name their community college in a positive light. So I mean, these are important things. So go ahead.
Yeah, Tagos, do you have a comment?
just a couple of things that I heard both at the New Haven meeting and the Stanford meeting. One common thread is I understand in New Haven the K-12 was bashed really, really badly. But so were some of the higher education institutions, in the sense they're not engaged, with the community, and they're not necessarily producing the skills the community needs. Now, that was common to both Stanford and New Haven. And I beg to disagree with what other people heard, but I think the University of Connecticut came in for a great deal of bashing and complaint. They just feel that it's isolated up in stores, they're not engaged with the community, and they better do something about it. And I don't know what they could, but in any case, I've heard that more than once. So yeah. We've got to take that seriously. There's something about the perception, at least, that that our institutions of higher learning are not engaged with the community, their welfare of the community, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the discussion I recall about UConn was more really positive sense of the direction of UConn, particularly that particularly related to engineering in Fairfield County, and Chris. You know, it probably was related to, nearness and connection with, you can do that in stores, but whether that's really connected to Fairfield County on some of the issues. But the other issue, I think, and that this is more of a question, was the extent to which there is really engagement of that institution in the region more generally. In other words, deeply engaged in participating in the economy, quality of life, and other aspects. And it was sort of a distance. I think, I don't know what, certainly they're not related to the community colleges, but particularly with more with the CSU institutions. Is that a...
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, my statements, or at least what I recall it, did not refer to community colleges.
Right, yeah. That,
can I just comment on that?
Yeah.
I had one other, I want to support what was just stated. And my terminal degree, my doctorate is from UConn, so I'm a, my terminal degree is from UConn, so I'm a supporter of the university. But the public goals that they're announcing now, including things like recruiting more of the highest quality high school graduate from outside the state of Connecticut and doing things like that, it seems to me it not only won't do anything to help realize the plans we have here, but that it may be counterproductive in that you're using the majority of the resources in the system, the part of the system that's most fully funded, to move in a direction that may move us up the U.S. World, whatever it is, the World Report, U.S. That magazine that has the ratings of universities. It may do something to advance us there, but it's not going
to
help us there. Okay. Well, I think that, and I know also with regard to the university that I taught in, Connecticut State University, there were times when the city of New Haven wanted to sell education buildings to the university for $1 that we could have invested in to help the students in New Haven, and they rejected it because the building committee or something said there had to be too much repair done to the building or it wasn't functional. I mean, there wasn't the degree of engagement that we're trying to work for here, and I support the goals here. I think in the long run they're practically and also ethically superior to some of the other goals that are more prestigious, more prestige-oriented. But I'm just wondering about that. I mean, I think it's a fair criticism that neither CSU nor UConn are engaged in the kinds of nuts and bolts of the economy we're talking about here.
Lindsay, you were at the New Haven one. Do you have any things that were different or?
No, I'm going back to the private-public sector partnerships and mentorships and engagements, and you're right, in terms of the output from Southern, I don't think there was any negative kind of statement except that their community engagement was lackluster, as was true with the others. In talking and interviewing employers, it seemed that Yale had the least desirable skills from their graduates of any of the institutions of higher learning. Their engineers were useless for the functional things that were needed by local employers. That does not mean that they're not rocket scientists. We just don't happen to have any rocket manufacturers.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really a... It's not only the need for engineers, but for engineers who, in fact, have a good match with... you know, in some respects, that's the difference between, you know, the engineers graduated from Central that fit with particular needs of the economy that are different from X, Y, and Z. So it's, I think there was a recognition of that kind of difference. Yes, sir.
I think one of the, going by the data we've had in the materials to read prior to now and in our conversation, I think it's wise for us to not disproportionately focus on the quality of the graduates, since the crying finding is that it's the quantity of the individuals that we need to be concerned about in Connecticut, that we don't have enough in each of these categories. Those that we have, of course, can be better, but those that we have are not deeply troubled products of dysfunctional systems. There aren't enough of them, right?
Right.
And so, and I think we want to focus on the idea that it's scale that's the question, and that we don't have enough, and that demographics determine who the population's going to be. And so, therefore, rather than a concern, which I can understand from any individual's perspective, about how a particular institution is spoken of, a more fundamental question is, are the higher education institutions in our state, are they actually aware that there are people over the age of 25 who need to go to school as undergraduates? And the answer is, there are a couple, but the very large majority continue to describe the majority of the student population, prospect population, as non-traditional. Well, they're the dominant sector, according to this data. I'm sorry, the dominant unserved population. So helping our schools make their own culture change, that it isn't about at the undergraduate level, whatever it is right now, it's a broader scope. And it doesn't mean that the existing experience is going to be appropriate for those. It's not just marketing to them. You know, one of the most interesting presidents I think we have out there is Jim Schmotter at Westcon. And he's an observer that, well, what are we going to do? Put a bunch of 55-year-olds in classrooms that we've spent a lot of time designing for 18-year-olds? Well, I mean, there's a level to which you could say better than nothing, sure. But there's also a level to which we want to say this is a new and fresh opportunity, right? And then I wanted to also go back to the whether it's soft skills or the idea of showing up on time. We've had some very interesting conversations with employers recently, and my colleague Cynthia Lyon has organized many of them as we expand our work with the 8 colleges in Fairfield County and our employers. And what really is emerging, and we've tried it and people seem to affirm it, we're talking not so much about skills in this area, they are important, but it's a culture. And we are a diverse society, and individuals are entering into a uniform culture. The culture of work is not one which prizes self-definition, right? It is one which prizes conformity, which is you show up on time. You behave in a way that... We are stressing acceptance of diversity. We are nurturing diversity. I mean of all kinds. We are nurturing self-expression. And then we're advising these students who are advised to build their skills, build their creativity, express themselves. Now we need to behave in a certain standardized way. That's the same thing you experience if you go to live in another country. You're living in another culture. And so the cultural translation is just as important as the training on the handshake and looking person in the eye when you shake their hand. It's why does that matter, right? And so this is the defining it as a skill set is useful, but putting that additional skill set in the context of the culture of private sector work in which there's a different set of requirements, I think that's useful for us to get into the conversation, because we can spend an awful lot of time training physical behaviors when actually the acceptance that I've gone somewhere else and I need to behave appropriately, understanding that leads to adaptation of that behavior much more rapidly than drilling in skills that are not connected to an understanding that I've gone to a new place, I need to behave in a new way.
So if recognizing that you all need to go to a different world, the thing I just want to maybe move this. If I was going to try to get Dennis on the phone, and that would take more time. But I think if he were here, he'd say at least to come out of this meeting with a clear understanding of basically two major goals. One is, in your words, that basically this state has a major challenge that it ought to really gain consensus around that 70%, which probably needs to be disaggregated to see if perhaps 40% with a baccalaureate degree and about 30% with associate and certificate. We can debate the details of that. And that to reach those goals requires a significant narrowing of all that subpopulation question as relates to adults, the gaps related to minority achievement. And the second point relates to the connection of higher education to the future economy of the state and the regions in which higher ed is really involved. His comment to me in looking over this Connecticut, he said what his number one worry is that the things currently going on, even with due respect to the legislature sitting here, are really just nibbling around the edges. That if you really looked at just motoring on with current capacity, the way teaching and learning is actually taking place now, simply feeding that and then doing a set of little projects on the end will in fact be a path to really be going south. And in fact, what you really need to have is a deep consensus of the extent of the challenge facing the state and the depth of the change that really needs to take place. So it goes back to the point about, you know, projects that are, you constantly visit states like this and they'll say, oh, we're already doing that, and then you add up the number of people doing it, 15 here, 20 there, 30 there, whereas the numbers we're talking about are thousands. So I guess if you all, I guess I'm that when we come back as a commission, the question is how do we really deepen the understanding of the crisis facing the state if it doesn't address that? You know, who does it need to reach out and gain, you know, a deeper understanding of that? And then the next question will be what kind of policy alternatives, you know, relate to that? And most often, in fact, people are doing what they're doing not because they're bad people, because they're doing what the incentive structure really gives them. And I think, as you will remember, one of our major themes related to affordability. And if you look at even the distribution of student aid currently, the level of funding, I think you made the speech this morning, if you look both level of funding and where the money goes, you're getting basically the performance that you should expect. You know, that there are not the incentives related to adults and there are not some other things like that. So that's the next phase, is really to how do you raise this up to a much more significant level and then put on the table the kinds of policy changes that Connecticut really needs to make.
This is a kind of basic question, but do we have the institutional capacity to make the 70% in terms of being able?
That is the most fundamental question we'll address at the next meeting.
Okay.
If you no, let me no, no, no. Let me answer. No, I think that if you look at where the current resources are allocated, I just put it on the table. You have a major part of your current contribution to degree production in the independent sector. To rely upon that sector totally is unaffordable for most students in the state. In fact, you cannot do that without a much different kind of student aid policy. And furthermore, the institutions themselves may not want to do it. You cannot just simply putting money more into the public sector, which is in fact getting not very many graduates through for the number of dollars you're investing, putting more money into that sector and having the same level of performance is not something you can do either. So those are the kinds of questions you've got to really raise. In order to get that, you have to have improved productivity across the system and then make strategic choices about where you're going to. There have been some states that I've been involved in saying, well, we have a lot of things being done in those high-priced private colleges. What we really need to do is build more public colleges. And you've got to look at them in their head and say, where in heaven's name is the money going to come for that? You know, and do they have the capacity to do that? So that's a very good question.
second part of my question is, if we're focusing on an older workforce, we understand that the work life of that person is somewhat shorter than a traditional student. What does that do also in terms of the turnover necessary in order to feed the workforce to the extent that we need it? And I don't know if you're doing calculations in that way, but that would be the next kind of mathematical question.
But it's not a one-time, isn't education, if somebody is educated, you know, as a young person, you're going to have to reinvest in that same person all the time. So you're saying if you educate somebody at age 20 to 29, that person will be?
Have a shorter work life. And what does that mean in terms of the numbers of people that you have to continually expand in order to create a workforce that's growing?
Yeah, in fact, that you do need to have the capacity to do that because you aren't going to have young people coming up.
Right, so it's just a mathematical question that I'm wondering if we have any analysis on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
This question is for Roberta. Let's suppose we work very hard, and we certainly intend to do that, and we're very careful and very thoughtful, and we come up with a first-rate plan to get to the 70% that Ames is talking about. How much pull do we have with the legislature and the politics and so on to get our plan through? I mean, from your perspective.
We've already started to have that conversation because, as you know, this commission is ongoing. So we're going to we have an interim report, and we'll produce a final report. But going forward, we're going to be looking at where are we as a state in terms of those benchmarks that we've established as a committee. So we're going to be hopefully grading the work or that's ongoing. But in terms of the political will to make that happen, that's something we're talking about now, how we do that. I mean, obviously, it's interesting because we're at the end of, you know, a governor's term, and so the future is, we don't know. But we have to engage other people outside of that. Certainly having all of you in the room here, your commitment to helping to advocate for this ongoing, should there be changes. But we're definitely looking at this. We're trying to come up with a plan, a way to fund this commission going forward. Those are all questions we are now massaging.
One of the things that you can see, having listened to the hearing this morning, one of the things you found in other states is if you really do a major effort to deepen the commitment of all the leaders, civic and business leaders of the state, that when issues are discussed before a legislative committee on specific matters, you'll find legislators increasingly saying, now wait a minute, that's interesting, but how does it relate to these goals we've already agreed to? So in fact, it's getting it into the water in the daily policy-making process that puts, you know, discussions about student aid, appropriations, and priorities really in context. And I think that's the way it will have the greatest impact, that you begin to see people saying, now we have to make a choice here. Is it really in line with these kinds of... Yes, sir.
And Ames, maybe putting words in your mouth, but maybe not. I heard you say that if we simply try to do more business as usual, we don't get there.
Absolutely.
And that the current definition of what we think of as a year's worth of higher education, for example, may have to change. And the emphasis for depending on the cohort on what we're trying to achieve, and the emphasis on certificates as opposed to degrees would seem to be a path that particularly you're looking at the adult learner or the individual who is behind the educational eight ball as a young adult. So alternative ways of entering into a productive employment life. So all of those things, when we then take into account the cost of how we organize and deliver higher education in this state, I'm going to argue that we're also, the idea, your observation of the alignment of the incentives, we're also going to need to look to some form of flexibility in what we are going to accept in delivery systems and not have them be constrained the way we are currently constrained. For example, the definition, the word adjunct is almost a four-letter word because of the risk it puts certain institutions into, and yet in some professions there is no other way to get access to the actual knowledge other than to go to an adjunct.
Right.
Because it's something that's being developed in the day it's used. And so when the institution offers the latest, most cutting-edge learning experience, they're penalizing themselves by affecting their adjunct ratio. So we have to enable some flexibility and not use very legitimate protections of quality from earlier generations to constrain our ability to respond to the needs today.
Yeah, the reality is that what institutions do in their first instance is really hunker down for their own particular survival. You know, what will be a business model which in fact generates revenue and gets things produced, and their short-term decisions may be directly contrary to the kind of goals that you really want to have done. And that's the one thing I want to stress is the other side of the picture. It goes back to your point, Mary Lou. I think that there's enough theme in this regional forum about how higher ed contributes to the quality of life and in order to be able to retain and recruit people to Connecticut. And, you know, I think that was, because that was certainly an emphasis in Fairfield, but it was also an issue, I think, in Middletown and several other places, that, in fact, it's an expensive place to do business. People are saying we can get engineers, but we can't get them to stick. You know, constant theme of how do we really have young people stay here. We can get people, but we can't compete. So I mentioned to Judy that this is a McGinnis fixation, but one of the things that Dennis and I have been involved in is something called regional stewardship, in which there are deliberate state policies that encourage public and independent institutions to be deeply engaged throughout their activities in the communities. That involves service learning, internships, activities to involve more efficient environmentally, you know, energy-saving activities, anything that relates to the sustainability and quality of life. And if you go back to, you know, institutions across Connecticut, higher ed institutions are a major part of the industry of this state, as well as the nonprofits. So the question is, do state policies really encourage places like Southern to be deeply engaged in the future of New Haven? Or is that basically up to the mission of the institution? Or is it? And what are the incentives? In the case of Kentucky, the state deliberately set up incentives for there to be partnerships with the institutions and the regional economic development people so that there was an expectation of a shared commitment to the future of that region. And I, for the life of me, I think that's something you all could encourage.
I'm curious. So can you go a little deeper with that? What is, did they give you any reasons or questions for why they weren't able to keep these professionals?
Pardon me?
Why weren't they able to have the professionals stay? So you said they were able to recruit engineers, but they didn't stick. So were there, is that because of the higher education component in the area, or is it other things? Is it inability to connect through arts and culture? Is it because they're too close to New York City, which is a big hub? Is that where they're going to go? And what is there a reason for people not staying there?
I'm going back to the discussions a little bit more in New Haven, but if you look at, they relate to all the problems that are only, I think they would be more sort of all in your other category. Access to amenities, affordable housing, transportation, accessibility to the arts and other things that communities expect, and in fact transportation to get from here to there and to still be connected. It can relate to access to technology and just the cost of living. I mean, is affordable housing there and the places to get together? So, and if you look across all those things, every single one of those issues are issues that the higher ed institutions in that same region are facing, even the retention of their own faculty members. But those institutions are likely to have more impact on the list that I just mentioned than virtually every other institution in the community. I just, you know, in the case of Judy, we visited Middletown, and you'll ask the question, is what is Wesleyan doing in that region? Well, there are a whole list of things that are being done sort of incidentally and coincidentally. They're deeply involved. They're not involved systemically in that, and they could be. The same thing with Southern. They may be or may not be, but if that's a major part of the mission. So it's interesting. It was less the graduates are fine, but we want these institutions deeply engaged as partners with us in the future. Now, that's kind of the conversation you're probably having.
We are, and also we've done some, or colleagues of ours have done some additional research in the demographics just of the city of Stanford. And so over the last 12 to 14 years, 10,000 young adults, 35 and under, have moved into new housing, apartments and condos, in downtown Stanford. And less than half of them work in Stanford. And it turns out that being close to New York is a reason to stay, not a reason to leave, because they can have affordable urban scale or a little bit more affordable in Stanford. They're 45 minutes by train from Midtown. And so there does seem to me this, there is to an emerging desire among young people to be in urban areas. This group had their average, 80% of them had more than a four-year degree out of these 10,000. Their average income is $110,000 per capita. 30% of them don't have cars. 25% of them don't have driver's licenses because they are new urban people. And so there's something about lifestyle choice that's embedded in this, that it's summed up in all the phrases,
right.
And that universities or the culture of that's created by, I think, the faculty of universities and then the undergraduates and graduate students, but faculty, graduate students, that makes cities really exciting to live in, is really keeping these young people here, not because of the jobs.
Yeah, I guess this is the... While if you look at Connecticut and the diverse economies and regions of Connecticut and really view those as having higher ed institutions, both public and independent, these basically the core of an intellectual and cultural climate, which in fact is linked with local economic development, to make that a sustainable, livable place for young people. I think that's what I'm really talking about. And whether that's just happening by coincidence, my sense is that it all could be much more deliberate to really say, and it goes back to your point, I mean, people will want to be, I just use my own community of Boulder. It's surprising how little University of Colorado Boulder and Boulder contributes in terms of educating people who are anywhere connected to there. But there is a culture there that in fact relates to the arts, access to young people, all sorts of loud music and a series of other things, places to eat that really come. So then the question, I think it relates to much more than this commission will deal with. It has to relate to tax policy and other things like that that have to make that work. So I want to put on that table, that is a major goal, that somewhere higher ed has to be connected with creating an economy that will not only train people but attract and retain the kind of the population that the state needs. That's kind of the theme. Okay, you all are there any things that I've done badly or no, you are granted that. I mean, that you've missed. So, Carrie, you've been out of my sight over here. So are there any things that are giving you apoplexy?
No, I mean, I think a lot of these things kind of inform some of the other strategic planning efforts that are going on. And Karen Bufkin from the Office of Policy and Management talked about it last time. A different and parallel track, the Higher Education Coordinating Council, also struggling to identify goals
right.
and metrics and how we measure our success. So I think this work is is really important, and I know it informed the policy that the governor recommended for Transform CSU 2020. So, very helpful.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, I think if you look at the list and the governor's priorities, they in fact match, you know, about 100% with all the kinds of, particularly the subpopulations that really need to be served, the advanced manufacturing, early child, you know, all those things. The real issue tends to be scale and whether we can really make transform the system. So that's great. Okay.
Ames, I was I am amazed that it is a little after quarter after five, and you're and there are still half the people that started this meeting are still here, which is encouraging that the conversation really got itself moving. I mean, did we hope to be further today? But no, but this was a much better outcome, I think, than we could have ever asked for about the engagement that happened today. I think we've got to go into our next meeting to confirm that those two major themes that Ames outlined today are really where we need to spend our time, you know, going forward at our next meeting. So I don't know if that works for you, but I want to make sure that we do go back and we look at this interim report again, we look at those themes that came out, and think about the conversation today. So as we go forward into our April meeting, I think we're finally at that moment where we can begin to take the clay and begin to move. So I'm thrilled, and I cannot thank you enough. It's actually 20 after my watch is slow. Just a reminder, next meeting, April 8th. That's a Tuesday. Right now it's in 1E, but we don't know. Or is that the end of session? We should be safe, so it'll be back downstairs. She'll probably be in session, yes. But thank you. There were a number of us that were under the weather, physically and meteorologically.
I just have one question to say. Are we going to plan another meeting with the different
we're going to need to meet with, following partly in our previous conversation, I think we're going to take a different approach, and it picks up with comments, a couple of you, that we in fact have a meeting at perhaps at the presidential level, you know, with the community colleges, with the state universities, go back with and talk with the independent sector, and then also with Susan Herbst at UConn, probably to summarize where we currently are in terms of the goals. And the next phase of this, what we really need to say, if those are the goals, what are the major policy barriers to getting from here to there? And that's the conversation we need to have. And in other words, it's not unlike the question you raised, Chris. It's fine to say, we're going to make a major shift and serve the adult population with these characteristics, but our current capacity is here. What kind of policy changes need to make? Or we're going to try to serve with a major emphasis on this sector, but it's simply there isn't the capacity to really do that. So what kind of policy changes need to be made in that? So that's why we definitely need to. So in April, we'll be back with a plan about how to do that. The second one, I think we can talk about how we get a much deeper engagement with your help. Honestly, we need the top business and civic leaders of the state, some of which you are, but your help and links with them to get this much more into the kind of conversation. You're creating an agenda that, in fact, then can begin to influence future years and then actually shape, part of that can help shape in a legislative agenda for the next session, but frankly, it's got to have a much more long-term impact than just, you know, session by session. Is that so? Yes, that was a long.
And with that, I thank you and wish everybody a safe trip home and good dinner and all that good stuff. Good conversation. Thank you.